What I do hope is that it may make you just a teeny bit interested in the Bible and actually asking what it's doing and where it's going. So, we'll see where you go. Taking the first of the two passages, juggling with glasses, it must be my age. When his family heard it, they went out to restrain him, for people were saying, he has gone out of his mind. Another version says, they went out to seize him. I think that's the Revised Standard Version, early version. You know, when I read that, I was quite taken aback. I mean, I've come across it a number of times before, but it suddenly hit me. I said, this is absolutely outrageous. You know, the family of Jesus is going along to wherever he's preaching, and they're coming to take you away, ha-ha. This is a very physical thing. They're actually going to drag him away. And that's quite outrageous. And to be honest, it reminded me of a bit of Monty Python's Life of Brian. I don't know if you saw Life of Brian. A lot of people got upset about it, but it was a very interesting film. It was portraying an imaginary character who was born more or less at the same time as Jesus, was living in the same sort of area, never actually met Jesus, but people kept mistaking Brian for Jesus and treating him like that, which was a bit embarrassing for him. And this came to a height when a great crowd were hanging around outside his house, waiting for him to do or say something significant. And his mother flings open a window and shouts, "He's not the Messiah, he's a very naughty boy." Okay, it's not an exact parallel, but I'm just reminded of that. It being, say, so outrageous that they should think of doing something like this. And so you could go a bit further into the passage, thinking, right, we'll see how this works out or what's going on here. Actually, Mark isn't very helpful about that. He just goes straight into Jesus' teaching about the scribes who've been sent from Jerusalem. Okay, the scribes have come down from Jerusalem. These are the men in suits from head office coming down to see what's going on in this far corner of the province and what's got to be done about it. And no, they are there to try and squash whatever might be developing here. And so they say that this healing and so on, it's obviously the work of the devil, not sanctioned by a head office, so it's got to be the work of the devil. And Jesus, it's quite interesting that they should take that approach, because, they could have just said, oh, it's a fake. These people weren't really ill in the first place, or, there are plenty of people doing this. It's all a put-up job. But obviously this was happening too close to home, and that wouldn't work. And so they say it's got to be the work of Satan. Whereupon Jesus said, well, that's very interesting, but I don't see how that works out. Jesus is working from the totally reasonable premise that it is God's intention for us to be as healthy and as content as is possible. It is the devil who wants to make life difficult for us, because that's what Satan does. And from that point of view, if it is Satan that is making these people well, then Satan is actually turning things on his head, because he's supposed to be keeping them down, not bringing them up. So that is totally illogical, says Jesus. And he actually goes on for quite a while, expanding this, rubbing their noses in it. And at the end, he makes a comment about anyone will be forgiven for blasphemy as long as they do not blaspheme against the Holy Spirit. So right at the end of that, the The scribes seem to have disappeared, and the family has now arrived. But they can't actually get anywhere near Jesus because he is surrounded by all the people who've come to hear him. And they have, the family have to try and pass messages through the crowd to get Jesus to hear. And his response to their demand that he starts behaving better is to say, "These are my family here, the ones who are actually following me and taking notice." So that was a sort of pretty devastating experience for the family, and I found that quite difficult. If you look at other Gospels, Matthew and Luke both have this story, but they do not have the initial one. They do not have the initial line about the family going to restrain Jesus. They go straight into Jesus' teaching. They have a rather more limited version of Jesus' teaching, but it is there. So they haven't heard, or they've decided to omit the bit about taking Jesus away. So why have we got into this state? How did it get Jesus' family turning up and wanting to cart him away? And in fact, we heard the answer to that, I think, in the introduction to the Gospel, which I hadn't planned, but you gave it to us, so thank you. In the passage immediately before this one, Jesus is taking his disciples to be commissioned, and he takes them up the mountain. It's always up the mountain. That's where Moses took his lieutenants and so on. Important things, encounters, closer encounters with God, go up the mountain. So, it's a very significant move here. And he commissions his disciples. And then straightway, we go into the story. So, for the family, they would have heard of the commissioning. Something like that doesn't get quiet. We can't be kept quiet. Word would have slinked out that Jesus had done this, had formally created his own movement. Up to that point, a little bit informal. He's now created the movement. And at the same time, the spies from Jerusalem are lurking in the background. So for the family, putting those two things together, we've got to try and keep him, for his own sake, we've got to try and shelter him from this. We've got to get him to come back. So that would explain them. But what about Jesus? Why is he so angry and so dismissive of his family? If he's just been up the mountain commissioning his disciples, if he then comes down and says, "Oh, sorry, got to leave you now. Family says dinner's on the table. Come back later." That would be a bit of a turn off. So I think Jesus is really... He can't afford to let that slip. He's commissioned them. He's now got to say, "Right, this is for real. You know, we're not going home to lunch. We're not going to come back now." So I just found that made a little bit more sense, and I could sleep a bit easier with the passage. Moving on then to the Old Testament passage. I'm sorry it was so long, but I couldn't resist this one. If you look on the plan, by the way, you won't find this as being the Old Testament passage for today. That's because in the lectionary you get two. You get a choice of Old Testament passages. One is continuous, that is, it goes throughout the year without any relevance to the Gospel passage. Or the related, where the Old Testament passage tries to be something suitable for, that ties in with the New Testament. And the one I couldn't resist bringing into the mix, the people of Israel saying they want a king, and Samuel getting rather upset. Samuel who has been guiding them through their various tribulations and excitements and so on. Samuel is getting old. He's getting too old, really, to make things happen. And his family is really not in the mould to take over. They are not part of the prophetic group. So something has to happen. And the people decide they want a king. Samuel is very upset about this, takes his concerns to God, and God says, "Don't worry, Samuel, not your fault. They've been kicking against me for ages. Just tell them what it's going to be like if they have a king. Just tell them that the king is going to get them into all sorts of disasters. The king is going to tax them. He's going to take away their money. He's going to take away their family to be his servants in his palace and so on and so forth. Just tell them all that. If they still want to go ahead, well, so be it." I mean, actually, what they could have done is say, "Look, we'll appoint someone to be king. We'll give him a bit of money, but we won't actually give him any power. We'll just let the politicians get on with that. He can just be a sort of figurehead, that sort of king." Might have worked, mightn't it? Sorry, a topical reference didn't go there, there. But this is all part of a section of the Bible that we call the Deuteronomic history. And it's all about showing how the people of Israel constantly disregarded God, and when they did that, things went wrong. And when they were more obedient to God, more sensitive to him, when their leaders or their kings were more devout and promoted the cause of the temple and so on, then things went well. That was their premise. And if some of the historical bits didn't quite meet the premise, then they would tone that bit down, and you get a rather shorter passage in the Bible for that king. Because that was the thrust of the whole Deuteronomic history, that when you follow God, when you follow his commands, things will go well, but when you ignore God, things will go wrong. So that is a theme that goes throughout Joshua, Judges, Samuel and Kings. Then straight after Kings in the Bible, you have mine's gone a blank, begins with C. Someone tell me, what comes after Kings in the Bible? Chronicles, thank you very much indeed. Down here, yeah. Then you have Chronicles, which edits out all the nasty bits about David and Solomon, because they're rather more pro-David and Solomon. Sorry, that's a diversion. Fast forward from that time, fast forward several centuries, and you're in England, and John Wesley is having his revival, and he is finding his movement is expanding. He needs a bit more of a group to look after things. He needs some more organization. And so he appoints 100 preachers. 100 preachers. John Wesley's 100 preachers. And they were the decision-making body for Methodism. How much of a look in the 100 got when John Wesley was around, I'm not absolutely sure. I think he was still sort of pulling most of the strings. But that was the way it was working. Then in 1791, John Wesley died. So what was going to happen then? Who was going to replace him? Well, there were quite a few people who had ambitions to replace him, and they were starting to line themselves up and get into the right place. At least one of them had to sort of jump on a ship from America to get back as soon as possible to be in the running. But the 100 preachers said, "No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to elect a replacement to John Wesley. There will be, as they said, this was the phrase they used, there will be no king in Israel." So there's a wonderful throwback there to the Deuteronomic history. And so to this day, Methodism does not have a president who can be a tyrant or who can take things over. we just appoint the president for 1 year only, and then they go back to being normal. The Secretary of Conference actually has quite a bit of power, and I've noticed that the district chairmen have to take quite a lot of notice of the Secretary of Conference. But nevertheless, the head person for a year, is only there for a year. And there's something of that principle carries down into the local government of our churches, that we have it in our constitution that a minister is no different from a layperson. There's nothing special about ministers, but it says for the sake of good order, we will set apart a team of ministers. They are no different to anybody else, but they're for the sake of good order, they're set apart for the word and preaching and communion. So today, your ministers do not have vast amounts of authority. We are here as servants of the people, and we are here for the sake of good order. And I think that is something that you can be very thankful for. So those are just my thoughts, with all the things that bubbled up when I came across the passages for today, and I hope you've got something from it. If not, you'll know it's because you don't have special people as ministers. We're going to sing a hymn.